I want everyone to think I'm smart. The sole technology in this section, logic, gives the members of your civilization a better way not only to reason, but to know that their reasoning is accurate. On top of that, it lays the foundation for machine-based reasoning down the road, as you'll see in section 17, computers. It's also one of the greatest achievements humans ever came up with, and since it took us hundreds of years to get it right, it's only logical that you now take advantage of this shortcut. 10.13.1 Logic. If the world were a logical place, men would ride side saddle. You. Also, Rita Mae Brown. What it is? A constructed system for structured thought that not only changed the way we think, but also eventually allows you to build machines that reason in the exact same way. Before it was invented, clear and correct abstract thought was literally more difficult. Originally invented, 350s BCE, which was when logic was first scientifically investigated by Aristotle, 300s BCE for the first propositional logic, 1200 CE for propositional logic being reinvented, and 1847 CE for propositional calculus being invented. Prerequisites? Spoken language. How to invent? The basics of logic were discovered several times throughout history, in China, India, and Greece, but it's the Greek version of it, Aristotle's syllogistic logic, that for historical reasons became the most influential, so that's what you're about to invent. In it, you start with axioms, things that are self-evidently true, and build up conclusions from there. A syllogism has a major premise, 1, a minor premise, 2, and a conclusion, 3. And they look like this. 1. All humans will die someday. 2. Imhotep is a human. 3. Therefore, Imhotep will die someday. Pretty straightforward, right? You can make all sorts of different arguments in this format. For example, 1. All time travelers have considered making out with their past selves. 2. All FC3000 users are time travelers. 3. Therefore, all FC3000 users have considered making out with their past selves. Or even, 1. All humans have flesh. 2. All flesh can get cool tattoos applied by placing pigment into the skin with sharpened sticks, animal bones, or needles. The top layer epidermis heals while the body's immune system engulfs the pigment particles beneath, stabilizing and concentrating the pigment just beneath the epidermis. 3. Therefore, all humans can get cool tattoos applied by placing pigment into the skin with sharpened sticks, animal bones, or needles. The top layer epidermis heals while the body's immune system engulfs the pigment particles beneath, stabilizing and concentrating the pigment just beneath the epidermis. Footnote, that's right, you just learned logic and how to give yourself some sick ink at the same time. End footnote. Since you can substitute different words into this structure, as we just saw, you can actually reduce your argument to symbols. Let's use S to stand for subject, M for middle, and P for predicate, which is just the thing we're stating about our subject. This produces 1. All M are P. 2. All S are M. 3. Therefore, all S are P. And that's the magic of syllogistic logic. If your premises are true, and the syllogism structure is valid, then it's impossible for your conclusion to not also be true. If all M are P and all S are M, then all S have to be P. It doesn't matter what M, P, and S are. If they meet these criteria, then that conclusion will always be correct. Syllogisms allow the humans in your civilization, for the first time, to reason about abstract logic and argument, rather than getting bogged down in the particulars of whatever argument's being made. Instead, the structure of the argument can indicate if an argument is invalid. Even if the premises are true, if they're not in a valid syllogistic structure, the conclusion does not necessarily follow. There are 15 valid logical syllogistic structures you can produce, and we're going to save your civilization years of hardcore logic and philosophizing by giving them to you right now. And here we have Table 16, Valid Logical Syllogism. The columns are major premise, minor premise, and conclusion. Major premise, all M are P. Minor, all S are M. Conclusion, therefore, all S are P. The next is major premise, no M is P. Minor, all S are M. Therefore, no S is P. The next is all M are P. Some S are M. Therefore, some S are P. The next is no M is P. Some S are M. Therefore, some S are not P. The next is all P are M. No S is M. Therefore, no S is P. The next is no P is M. All S are M. Therefore, no S is P. The next is all P are M. Some S are not M. Therefore, some S are not P. The next, no P is M. Some S are M. Therefore, some S are not P. The next, all M are P. Some M are S. Therefore, some S are P. The next, some M are P. All M are S. Therefore, some S are P. The next, some M are not P. All M are S. Therefore, some S are not P. The next, no M is P. Some M are S. Therefore, some S are not P. The next, all P are M. No M is S. Therefore, no S is P. The next, some P are M. All M are S. Therefore, some S are P. And finally, no P is M. Some M are S. Therefore, some S are not P. Table 16 is labeled Valid Logical Syllogisms. This is something that took humanity thousands and thousands of years to puzzle out, and it all fits in a single 15x3 grid. Hooray! You can come up with other syllogistic structures, but they'll either be wrong, for example, saying that all M are P and all S are M, and then concluding that therefore no S are P is straight up baloney, or your syllogisms will produce conclusions that are weaker than those you've already got above. For example, if all poodles are dogs and all dogs are mammals, then concluding that some poodles are mammals, while technically correct, is pretty misleading. This leads us to a very important civilization pro tip. Civilization pro tip, all poodles are definitely mammals. Once invented by Aristotle, syllogisms stood without major modification for over 2,000 years. But while they're useful for organizing thought, they're not perfect. They rely on language, which can always be muddy or imprecise. As an example, imagine if you'd concluded through perfectly logical reasoning that, therefore, some dinosaur is feared by all safety-minded time travelers. One person might read that sentence as, every safety-minded time traveler fears at least one dinosaur, while another might read the same words and conclude there's a single, colossal, mega dinosaur out there that all safety-minded time travelers fear. Is that true? It seems important to know. It took a while, but humans eventually realized that if they could transform syllogisms into a calculus they could solve, then they would be able to explore logic and reason with the ultimate precision of mathematics. Footnote, how long? Well, propositional logic was invented around 300 BCE, lost, reinvented around the 1200 CE, and then refined into symbolic logic in the 1800 CE by George Boole, from whose name we get the word Boolean, meaning either true or false. End footnote. This line of reasoning would eventually lead to something called propositional calculus, which, despite its super impressive name, is actually really simple. Footnote. In fact, this greater precision is what led humans to realize that several of the syllogisms Aristotle put forward weren't actually correct. We showed you 15 of them, but Aristotle's original list was longer, and it was only when we finally examined these syllogisms with the more precise propositional calculus that several of them were found to work only when you presuppose that a class has members. In other words, when you assume the set of things being considered actually exist. As an example, one erroneous form was all M are S and all M are P, therefore some S are P. This worked with things that exist. If we were to argue that all horses are mammals, and all horses have hooves, therefore some mammals have hooves, you would say, yes, duh, I know. But the same syllogism completely falls apart if M refers to things that don't exist. Using the same form, and with premises that are equally true, we could argue that all unicorns have horns, and all unicorns are horses, therefore some horses have horns. But until they were genetically engineered in the 21st century, miniaturized, and adopted as one of the most popular, if unpredictable, house pets, no horses had horns. An incorrect conclusion is produced because the syllogism is flawed. It's only fixed if you add an existential clause to your syllogism by saying, if all M are S, and all M are P, and M exist, then some S are P. Humans like to think they're pretty smart, but multiple errors like this in Aristotle's reasoning, which would have been discovered way earlier had generations of logicians only used more unicorns in their example sentences, stood for over 2,000 years. End footnote. Take a syllogism we've already seen as an example. All time travelers have considered making out with their past selves, and all FC3000 users are time travelers, therefore, all FC3000 users have considered making out with their past selves. We saw how this reduces to all MRP and all SRM, therefore, all SRP. If we replace the word R with the symbol meaning implies, an arrow, then this syllogism can be written as M implies P, and S implies M, therefore, S implies P. In other words, if time travel implies make-out thoughts, and the FC3000 implies time travel, then the FC3000 implies make-out thoughts. Sorry, time travelers, but it's true. Now, to shorten the amount we have to write, let's replace AND with an upwards arrow symbol and introduce brackets so it's clear which variables go together. This gives us open bracket M implies P close bracket and open bracket S implies M close bracket, therefore S implies P. Replace therefore with a symbol of its own, three dots in a triangle shape. Replace M, P, and S with more generic and sequential variables P, Q, and R, and swap the order of our statements to make them more intuitive, and you'll get this argument in its final form. P implies Q, and Q implies R, therefore P implies R. In other words, if P implies Q and Q implies R, then P implies R. It's the same argument we saw when traveling through time to our two seductive past selves, distilled to pure symbolism. Here's another simple argument. Not P, which you can represent as a notched line in front of P, is the opposite value of P. Our logic will deal only with things that are either true or false, so not true is the same as saying false, and not false obviously means true. And given that, we can easily prove that not P must therefore equal P. All you need to do is write out all possible options, of which there are precisely two. And here we have table 17, with three columns, P, not P, and not P. If P is true, then not P is false, and not P is true. If P is false, then not P is true, and not P is false. This is table 17 labeled, these are called truth tables, and you just used one to prove that P equals not P. Look, we won't say just yet that you're history's greatest logician, but we will say this, you're definitely history's greatest logician so far. This is all it takes to prove the proposition P, therefore not P, is valid. That probably seems like a pretty simple thing to prove, and it is, but you're laying a foundation of valid argument forms that you'll be able to use to manipulate and prove much more complex propositions. By putting your reasoning in symbolic format like this, you're not just working out rules for how these variables can interact with one another, you're also discovering actual rules for logical reasoning itself. You're figuring out a new way to think that's provably accurate. You, my friend, are inventing logic. We put a list of the valid forms of argument in Appendix D, and if you decide to produce an extremely logical civilization, they'll save you a lot of time. This is, of course, just one way to build a system of logic. You can build more complicated ones that rely on degrees of truth, capture more complicated relationships, and so on. Footnote. For degrees of truth, you can look at a fuzzy logic system. This is where a statement can be marked as zero for false, one for true, but anything else in between. Here, 0.9 is almost true, 0.0001 is practically false, and 0.5 is halfway between true or false. Second footnote, for more complicated relationships, you can introduce other operators for different relationships, like diamond P to mean it is possible that P. This roughly equates to the sum MRP statements we saw in Aristotle's syllogisms. End footnote. The reason we taught you this system is that it deals in either absolute truth or absolute falsehood, with nothing in between. It's binary. And as you'll see in Section 17 Computers, you'll be able to use binary logic to build machines that reason just as logically as you can, but at thousands of times the speed. Logic is the only way you get to play video games and watch movies in bed again. Civilization pro tip, you're welcome. This concludes the section of technologies you can use to address common human complaints, and we now move on to chemistry, philosophy, art, and medicine, technologies that, even though they may not be requested by name, still greatly improve any civilization. Chapter 11. Chemistry. What are things, and how do I make things? The trick in chemistry is never to overreact. Chemistry is a science of digging things out of the ground and transforming them into other, more useful things. These transformations can take many forms, and fully understanding them can take a lifetime of study. We've only got a few pages here, though, so instead, get ready for some pure, free-based information. What are things made of? This is one of the most fundamental questions humans have ever asked, and coming up with a response to it took humanity thousands of years of study. Nobody has time for that, so here's the answer. Things are made of atoms, which are tiny pieces of matter around 0.1 nanometers long. At the center of atoms is a core, the nucleus, which is made out of positively charged protons, hence the name, and neutrally charged neutrons, again, hence the name, and which constitutes 99.9% of an atom's mass. There are more than 100 different kinds of atoms called elements. The number of protons in each atom's core determines which element it is. Any atom with one proton is hydrogen, any with eight is oxygen, and any with 33 is arsenic. As you'll need oxygen to survive, but arsenic will absolutely kill you, you'll definitely want to have a passing familiarity with how many protons atoms have. Luckily for you, we've made a big chart showing that and how they relate to one another called the periodic table, which you can see in Appendix B. It's a complete table, accurate to 2041 CE, the year in which it was last changed. While atoms can't gain or lose protons without becoming a different element, they can gain or lose neutrons and still stay whatever they are. These variants are called isotopes. An isotope with more neutrons will weigh more than an isotope with fewer. Around the nucleus of each atom resides one or more negatively charged electrons. Electrons travel in different orbits, some closer, some farther out. The smallest orbit can hold 2 electrons, but the next one can hold 8, the next larger one 18, and so on, according to the formula 2 times n squared, where n is your shell number. And while electrons tend to stick close to the nucleus, an inner shell doesn't always have to be filled with electrons for them to begin populating an outer shell. So given all that, here's a rough model of what an atom looks like, schematically. Here we have figure 49, showing 5 different elements. The first is hydrogen, with 1 electron and 1 proton. That electron is in a single orbit. The next is oxygen, with 8 protons in the core and 8 electrons outside. The lowest orbit has 2 electrons, and the next one has 6. Next is sodium with 11 electrons and 11 protons. The first orbit has 2, the next has 8, and the outer orbit has just 1. Next we have chlorine with 17 electrons and 17 protons in a 2, 8, 7 orbit. And finally we have arsenic with 33 electrons and 33 protons. 2 in the first orbit, 8 in the next one, 18 in the next one, and 5 in the outer shell. Figure 49 is labeled Schematic Views of Several Elements. If you were expecting a chemistry pun here, we apologize. We're not good, atom. Atoms can combine with other atoms to form molecules. These are the chemical reactions you've heard about. An atom's electrons can give you a clue about how reactive it is. Atoms want to have that outer orbit filled with electrons, so elements that have achieved this will be less reactive than those that don't. And it generally goes how you expect. Elements with two extra electrons tend to react with elements that need two more. This does imply that atoms that already have their outer shells filled up with electrons, elements like helium or neon, won't want to react with anything, and they don't. Helium and neon are so unreactive that molecules containing them were actually thought to be impossible. They're not. We've made some. It's no big deal. But they usually require extremely high pressure and/or extremely low temperatures. End note. While helium and neon compounds are presumably available in every corner drugstore in the future, here in the present they're a little harder to come by. They have, however, been briefly created under the high pressure, low temperature circumstances mentioned in the text. End note. Let's look at water as an example of a chemical reaction. Two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom can combine to form water, or H2O. That subscript 2 is what tells you there are two hydrogen atoms. The oxygen has 6 electron slots filled in its outer shell, and hydrogen atoms have 1 each. So the two hydrogens share their electron with the oxygen, a water molecule is formed, and if atoms can be said to be happy, these ones are. Footnote, they can't, but we ascribe emotions and desires and motivations to inanimate matter because it makes explanatory rhetoric so much easier. End footnote. This sharing of electrons is called a covalent bond. But there's another wrinkle to consider, electrical charge. Electrons have a negative charge, protons have a positive charge, and since most elements have the same number of electrons and protons, these charges cancel out, and the atoms are electrically neutral. However, atoms don't always share electrons, like we saw when we were making water. They can also exchange them. When that happens, one atom loses electrons, while another gains them, and this gives the resulting atoms overall positive or negative charges. In electrical charges, and occasionally interpersonal romance, opposites attract while likes repel. An example of this, sodium, Na on your periodic table, has 11 electrons, so that's 2 at the first level, 8 at the next level, and just 1 at the outer level. Chlorine, Cl, has 17 electrons, which means 2 at the first level, 8 at the next level, and 7 at the outer level. Chlorine wants one more electron to get to 8. If sodium can get rid of one electron, it'll get to 8 too, so that's what happens. However, when sodium loses that extra electron, it ends up with a positive charge, and when chlorine gains one, it ends up with a negative charge, so they attract each other and bond anyway. This resulting chemical, NaCl, is salt, and this bond caused by electrical attraction is called an ionic bond. Covalent bonds are more easily broken, the sharing of electrons is more temporary, and result in chemicals that are usually liquid or gaseous at room temperature. Covalent bonds happen only between nonmetals. Metals and nonmetals are all listed on the periodic table, along with semimetals, which are in-between elements that can have the properties of both. Ionic bonds are harder to break, result in solids at room temperature, and usually occur between a metal and a nonmetal. Guess what? Reading those last few paragraphs took you all the way from 13,799,000,000 BCE to humanity's state-of-the-art understanding in the middle of the 1900 CE. It took us until 1800 CE to even figure out what elements are. So heck, even if you just skim the first few paragraphs, you're already doing fine. To go further, you'll need to know that both protons and neutrons are made out of even smaller particles, called quarks, which themselves come in 6 wacky flavors. Footnote. They actually are called flavors, and they actually are wacky. The flavors are up, down, top, bottom, charm, and strange, in order of increasing wackiness. For more information on quarks, please refer to, assuming you brought it with you, The Time Traveler's Guide to Quarks, which are useful for building time machines, and yet you'll still need to know a heck of a lot more for building one successfully, but heck, who am I to stop you, so enjoy reading about quarks, I guess, Volume 9. End footnote. You also need to know that electrons don't so much orbit a nucleus as exist as waves in an unobservable area of potential locations rather than at a single point. Footnote. When things get very small, they also tend to get very weird, which is about as detailed a summary of quantum mechanics as you can expect to find in a footnote of a non-quantum mechanics text. In fact, if you'd like to pose as an expert on quantum mechanics, just repeat that first clause of this footnote in response to any question you receive, and you'll be off to a great start. End footnote. But you're not going to need that level of detail in your current circumstances unless you're trying to build a time machine, which you won't be, because building a time machine is so hard that it was easier for us to write a guide on how to reinvent civilization from scratch than to even begin explaining where to start. The existence of atoms is hard to prove without extremely powerful microscopes, but you can observe their effects easily. Dust in a glass of water, for example, will move about randomly. This "your name here" motion, originally Brownian motion, after this botanist named Robert Brown who discovered it in 1827 CE, occurs because the dust is being knocked around by tiny particles, i.e. molecules, of water. Where do things come from? The Big Bang in 13,799,000,000 BCE, which would have definitely been worth checking out if your time machine wasn't busted, sent matter out into the universe, and this matter coalesced into mostly hydrogen, the simplest element. Gigantic masses of hydrogen eventually coalesced into such huge balls of gas that the pressure of their own weight started fusing hydrogen in their cores. Hydrogen has one proton, and it was being fused into helium, which has two. This process released a lot of energy, and also is exactly what our and every other sun is. This process can last anywhere from millions to trillions of years, depending on the size of the star, until the hydrogen runs out. When that happens, if the star is big enough, it'll have enough pressure to start fusing helium instead. Helium fuses into the higher elements, from lithium with three protons, all the way up to carbon with six protons, with carbon being favored. Footnote: how does helium, two protons, fuse with itself to produce elements with an odd number of protons? The answer is that sometimes protons and neutrons break away during fusion, which is how helium, with two protons, can fuse with itself to produce lithium, with three protons, boron, with five protons, or any of the other odd-numbered elements. End footnote. Once the helium is gone, and again, if the sun is big enough, it'll start fusing the carbon too, which forms elements up to magnesium, with 12 protons. This stage can last around 600 years. If the sun is supergiant, this process can repeat, forming elements all the way up to iron, with 26 protons. At that point, however, things start to break down. Iron costs more energy to fuse than it produces during that fusion, so any star fusing iron is going to die soon, usually in less than a day. At this point, the sun dies, and depending on how big it is, it either collapses and becomes a cooling husk, called a white dwarf when it's cooling, and a black dwarf when it's completely cooled, and so dense that a cubic centimeter of it would weigh more than 3 tons, or it becomes a neutron star, which is a white dwarf with so much pressure that all the matter inside is packed with the same density as in an atomic nucleus. A cubic centimeter of this would weigh almost 1 billion tons. Or, as a third option, it could become a black hole, which is a neutron star so heavy not even light can escape its grasp, and which honestly you should not be messing around with even a cubic centimeter of. So this explains where all the elements up to iron come from, stellar fusion. But what about the heavier elements? Well, we skipped over a stage in that last paragraph. When stars die, sometimes the gases that used to be held away from the core by the energy spewing out from the sun find nothing holding the force of gravity back, and the sun undergoes a final, catastrophic collapse. All its mass collapses inward, causing such heat and pressure that protons and electrons are fused into neutrons. And then it explodes. It actually explodes so powerfully that one of the few explosions bigger is the Big Bang itself. These explosions, called supernova if they're normal-sized and hypernova if they're colossal, blast matter outward in a huge particle storm with such energy that they can, for about a month, burn brighter than 1 billion suns. This creates highly unstable nuclei that decay into other elements, including those heavier than iron, which makes a supernova the only place in the universe where heavier elements get made, at least until we started synthesizing them on Earth around 1950 CE. It's also why hydrogen and helium are by far the most abundant elements in the universe. You need stars to slowly produce everything else. Elements that aren't helium or hydrogen actually make up just 0.04% of the universe, which, since you're carbon-based, unfortunately makes the matter that you, and everyone you've ever known is made out of, minor enough to be dismissed as a universal rounding error. If you're feeling down about that, just remember where you come from. Awesome explosions. What can I make out of things? Technically, everything. And to help you get started with that, we provided instructions on how to build many useful chemical things from scratch in Appendix C, which will definitely come in handy given your current circumstances. We've also included the chemical makeup for each. You don't need to know this information to produce them, but knowing their origins is a useful foundation for you or your descendants to build out the rest of your chemistry knowledge. And again, we'd like to stress here that several of these chemicals are dangerous, which is why we named that appendix Useful Chemicals, How to Make Them, and How They Can Definitely Kill You, and not Useful Chemicals, How to Make Them, and How They Are Super Fine to Rub Directly into Your Bare Eyes Without Any Problems Whatsoever. Please now either jump ahead to Appendix C to begin your exploration of chemistry, or, alternatively, leave that for a while, turn this page, and learn about some cool philosophy instead. Chapter 12. Major schools of philosophy summed up in a few quippy sentences about high fives. Is it solipsistic in here, or is it just me? The philosophical groundings of your civilization are entirely up to you, but this extremely superficial overview of several world philosophies drawn from throughout history may prove to have several useful idea starters for your own civilization. These philosophies can be combined, expanded, weakened, strengthened, and deconstructed in hundreds of different ways, so feel free to do exactly that. The difficult and often existentially terrifying work of philosophy demands you confront the heavy questions of life and existence head-on, which can be both disorienting and depressing. As you probably have enough problems already, instead of describing these philosophies in terms of the search for meaning and purpose in life, their usual alleged purpose, we'll instead discuss them in terms of high fives, which are universally cool and fun. First, we have religious philosophies. Monotheism. God gave me a high five. Polytheism. One or more gods gave me a high five. Henotheism. There may be other gods, and there may not. All I know is the one I worship gave me a high five. Monolatrism. There are definitely a bunch of gods, but I worship only the one who gave me a high five. Pantheism. The universe, which is equivalent to a god, gave me a high five. Panentheism. The universe, which has divinity throughout it, but which is not equivalent to a god because any god is greater than the sum of the universe, gave me a high five. Omnism. All religions can give you different kinds of high fives, but no single religion can offer the complete high five experience. Panpsychism. Everything in the universe has consciousness and could therefore desire to give me a high five. Aietzism. Some sort of god somewhere out there gave me a high five, but beyond that, who is to say? Agnosticism. Maybe a god gave me a high five. Maybe I gave it to myself. Who is to say? Atheism. I gave myself a high five. Autotheism. I gave myself a high five, and also, I'm a god. Apatheism. Wondering whether or not gods exist and are handing out high fives is hugely irrelevant. None of you have better things to do? Agnosticism. The idea of a god has no unambiguous definition, so arguing about whether or not they exist and are currently handing out high fives is meaningless. Deism. God or gods definitely exist, but they would never interfere with human affairs, so I'm pretty sure that's the only reason why none of them have ever given me a high five. Dualism. There are good and bad forces in the world. For every high five, there is a corresponding anti-high five that is both down low and, sadly, too slow. Antitheism. Gods handing out high fives do not exist, but if they did, I would totally leave them hanging. Mesotheism. Gods handing out high fives definitely exist, but their high fives are way nasty. Solipsism. I gave myself a high five. Unfortunately, I only imagined it since nothing outside my own mind really exists. Secular humanism. There are no gods to high five us, but we can still be kind, and we can still high five each other. Philosophies of being. Nihilism. Nothing, not even high fives, has any meaning. Existentialism. Nothing, not even high fives, has any meaning, so it's up to the individual to give them whatever meaning they can by both handing out and receiving high fives as authentically as possible. Determinism. I'm high-fiving you, but free will is an illusion. If you could rewind the universe and run it again, all would be identical, and we would still end up high-fiving at this exact moment. Consequentialism. Anything is justified, no matter how horrible, as long as it results in me getting a high-five. Utilitarianism. Anything, no matter how horrible, that brings the greatest number of high-fives to the greatest number of people is justified. Positivism. If you want me to believe in high-fives, then I'm going to need to see some scientific evidence. Objectivism. It is in my rational self-interest to get high-fives, and any authority that does not respect my individual right to dispense and receive high-fives in whatever manner I so choose is bad. Hedonism. High-fives feel great, and pleasure's awesome, so I'm going to hand them out for as long as I want. Don't talk to me about consequences. If it feels good to high-five while having sex, I might actually try that. Pragmatism. High fives are only good if they can accomplish something. Empiricism. Do not trust intuition or tradition. The only true way to fully understand high fives is to give and receive them for yourself. Stoicism. Emotions can result in errors of judgment that interfere with clear and unbiased thinking. Therefore, the best high fives are those given out for extremely logical reasons. Absolutism. Certain actions are intrinsically right or wrong. For example, stealing, even to feed a starving puppy, might always be wrong, while high fives, even if you keep accidentally slapping the person in the face real bad, might always be the correct course of action. Epicureanism. Pleasure's awesome, but the greatest pleasures are the absence of pain and fear, so I'm going to high only a sensible number of fives, because I don't want to end up with a hurt hand. Absurdism. The sheer size, scope, and potential of things to understand about even one single high five makes ever discovering the true meaning of high fives impossible, and the only rational responses are suicide or blindly hoping there's a god who could one day completely understand high fives, or, failing either of those, just accepting the absurdity of high fives and, despite it all, still cheerily handing them out. This was Table 18, which is labeled, just as an aside, the phenomenon in which you encounter a word or phrase like high five over and over and over until it loses all meaning is called semantic satiation. High five. Chapter 13, The Basics of Visual Art, Including Some Styles You Can Steal. With these instructions, you'll be able to paint with any color you can produce. Colors you can't yet produce, however, will remain pigments of your imagination. Look, we didn't want to have to do this. We wanted to say, just draw some pictures, you'll figure it out, it'll be fine. But history has proven us wrong. You know how if you look down a straight line of train tracks, the rails seem to converge at a vanishing point on the horizon? If you do, you're already doing better than the great mass of humanity in most every other time period, because until 1413 CE, humans hadn't figured that out yet. Footnote, and yes, these humans didn't have train tracks, but that's no excuse. Fields of grain, fences, even rivers and coastlines all produce the same convergence effect. End footnote. That's the reason old paintings always look so wonky. Not a single human on the planet knew how to draw in correct perspective. And here you might be saying, oh, I don't know about that. Maybe the ancient Egyptians just loved the anti-perspective style they came up with a whole lot. This was wherein the size of the figures was related to how important they are thematically, rather than where they were situated in space. And maybe that's why they never use correct perspective in a drawing even once. And you might have an argument if it were not for the fact that throughout history, whenever perspective was discovered, artists go completely bonkers for it. Here's Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper, one of the most famous paintings in the world, painted in 1495 CE, just 80 years after Europeans first figured out what perspective is. And here we have Figure 50, The Last Supper. If you haven't seen it, it's a picture of a bunch of people eating dinner, all on one side of the table. Behind them, the walls and roof converge to three open windows. Figure 50 is labeled The Last Supper. That arch at the bottom is a doorway, added later, after some humans decided it was really important that they have convenient ingress and egress through a priceless work of art. Now imagine that picture in your mind. Look at that tiled roof. Look at those squares along the walls and thick rectangular windows at the back. This is a painting that is at best one-third, I love religion, so I'm going to paint my favorite religious figures enjoying a meal, and at least two-thirds, bro, my vanishing point is off the hook. Seriously, check out my wall rectangles. You don't even know. Here's Raphael's masterpiece, The School of Athens, from 1509 CE. And here we have Figure 51, The School of Athens. It shows a dome-shaped view into a long geometric hallway with tons of philosophers sitting around on geometric steps, with one philosopher in the foreground writing on a cube. It's labeled Figure 51, The School of Athens. It was painted on a wall in Italy. Picture that in your mind. Do you notice the figures first? Or do you notice the tiled floor, the series of arched roofs, the steps, and the guy writing on an actual cube in the foreground, all rendered in deliberate, in-your-face, single-point perspective? When modern humans first invented computer ray tracing, they generated thousands, if not millions, of images of reflective chrome spheres hovering above checkerboard tiles, just to show off how gorgeously ray tracing rendered those reflections. When they invented lens flares in Photoshop, we all had to endure years of lens flares being added to everything, because the artists involved were super excited about a new tool they'd just figured out how to use. The invention of perspective was no different. And since it coincided with the Renaissance going on in Europe at the same time, some of the greatest art in the European canon is dripping with the 1400 CE equivalent of lens flares and hovering chrome spheres. Of course, earlier artists knew that things got smaller the farther away they got, but they had no mathematical theory behind it, and so had to guess at how things would look, which gave extremely mixed results. Some artists got close, like those in China after around 1100 CE, where a form of drawing now called oblique perspective generated illustrations that didn't correspond to any view you'd see in real life, but at least gave an approximate sense of 3D objects in space. And here we have Figure 52, an untitled painting of a mill produced in China around 1100 CE. You can see buildings and fences in front of those buildings, all kind of in perspective, but not quite. Everything's a little bit wacky. What made perspective finally click was the discovery of vanishing points. The lines of a railroad track you were imagining earlier go off into the distance, apparently converging on a single point on the horizon where they disappear. If you render all shapes doing that, if the imaginary lines suggested by walls, buildings, cubes, and everything else all vanish towards the same point, you can produce a convincing image of the world as if viewed through a window. That's what you're seeing in The Last Supper. Here we have Figure 53, an altered version of The Last Supper. Every vanishing point line has been drawn on top of the image, and they all converge just behind Jesus' head. It's labeled Figure 53, an altered version of The Last Supper, designed to help put things in perspective. That's one-point perspective, where vertical lines are all parallel, and objects are viewed head-on. You can make it more complicated by rotating objects so their faces are angled away from you. Vertical lines are still parallel, but now each face has its own vanishing point, giving two-point perspective. And here we have Figure 54 showing just that. If you imagine a cube viewed right from the side, and then slightly above you and slightly beneath you, you'll see what two-point perspective offers. Finally, three-point perspective adds a vanishing point above or below the object. Vertical lines are no longer parallel, but angle towards their own vanishing points. Here we have Figure 55. If you imagine a cube positioned just to your left or right and slightly beneath you, you'll have an idea of what three-point perspective looks like. Figure 55 is labeled three-point perspective. Extra-dimensional perspectives are left as an exercise for the reader. This technique isn't perfect. Technically, any perspective drawing should only appear accurate when viewed from a single location where those vanishing points would make sense. But human brains are great and invisibly correct for a lot of things that don't technically make sense. They automatically convert a rapid series of images into apparent motion in flipbooks, which you can easily invent, and in motion pictures, which will be a little more work. They automatically convert the fact that sounds arrive in our ears at slightly different times into a distinct sense of location. That's why you have a sense of where sounds originate around you. And they automatically make any drawing in perspective look convincing, even when not viewed from the precisely correct angle. So that's the basics of perspective, and even knowing just this will allow you to create much more convincing and realistic images of the world around you. But realism isn't the only purpose of visual art, a fact that historically gets underlined once photography is invented. Once artists realize that and get over realism, other styles start to be explored. And here there really is no limit. Below are some examples of different styles of visual art which will allow you to kickstart the minds of artists in your civilization. With any luck, they'll leapfrog over what we created and generate new and astounding works of art beyond anything we've ever considered. Good luck. And here we have Figure 56, Art. There are 9 drawings of a dog. The first is primitive, an amateurish outline of a dog. The next is Egyptian, an angular dog that looks kind of like a cat. The next is medieval, a wonky-looking dog with lines all over him that looks a little like a dragon. Next is Renaissance, the Mona Lisa as a dog. Next is post-impressionist, a really good-looking dog. The next is cubist, a dog reduced to component shapes, broken apart, and reassembled. The next is surrealist, a iconic representation of a dog labeled Ceci n'est pas un chien. The next is minimalist, a collection of lines that just suggest a dog. And finally, pop art, with the word woof bursting out of a comic book explosion. This is Figure 56, Art. Sidebar, where can you get pigments? You can get black pigment from coal or charcoal, add it to water or oil and you've made paint, but other colors can be a bit trickier. Grinding up different minerals has been a source of pigment as far back as 400,000 BCE. Just collect rocks of a color you like, reduce them to powder, wash them to remove any water-soluble parts, dry them out, and you're good to go. You can get other colors from biological sources, and ground up insects, mollusks, and even dried out poops have been used in the past. It's very easy to go too far. A shade of yellow called Indian yellow was once made by feeding cows only mango leaves until they were so malnourished that their urine turned the bright yellow desired. A favorite shade in 1600 CE in Europe, called mummy brown, was made by grinding up ancient mummies, feline and, yes, human, to paint with their remains. Vibrant shades of blue and purple are historically the hardest to produce. Until 1704 CE, one of the most vibrant shades of blue, ultramarine, was available only by grinding up a rare mineral called lapis lazuli. Footnote, the synthetic blue pigment discovered in 1704 CE was actually not the world's first artificial pigment. It was the first one Europeans came up with, but back around 3000 BCE, the Egyptians, also annoyed at how expensive grinding up lapis lazuli was, managed to produce an artificial version of the color by combining, under heat, some quartz sand, copper, calcium carbonate, and alkaline ash. This technique was used for thousands of years, but by 400 CE, every single person who'd known how to make it had died without telling someone else the technique or writing it down, and the knowledge of how to make an inexpensive substitute for one of the most expensive colors on the planet was lost. Everyone, this is what happens when you keep really important knowledge a secret and then die. End footnote. A painting of an ultramarine sky was therefore a status symbol, showing you could afford to reduce precious stones to dust just to make a painting. The color purple's association with royalty also originates in purple pigments being extremely expensive. At certain points in time, some were worth their weight in silver. The best purples were produced by extracting a mucus, normally used by the snails to sedate their prey, from a tiny, 6 to 9 centimeters long species of snail found in the Mediterranean Sea. Getting that mucus was extremely labor-intensive. You either had to poke two snails to get them to attack, thereby milking them, or grind up the snails to get at the mucus that way. Either way, it took 12,000 snails to produce only around 1 gram of pure dye. If you're interested, these snails evolved around 3,600,000 BCE, hence the famous time traveler saying that if there are other humans around, then there's always the potential to make some really, really expensive purple dye in one part of the Mediterranean. Chapter 14, Heal Somebody, Medicine, and How to Invent It. Recreating medicine in the past will require you have some patience. Hippocrates was a man who introduced two major ideas to Western medical treatment around 400 BCE, one marginally useful and one incredibly catastrophic. The marginally useful one was a Hippocratic oath, which is still used today by many doctors who, for some reason, feel compelled to publicly promise that they won't intentionally kill their patients. The catastrophic one was a formalized humor theory of disease. The humor theory holds that all diseases, across all forms of life, are caused by an imbalance in one of the four humors inside our bodies. Those humors are blood, phlegm, black bile, and yellow bile. Well, this was arguably an improvement over past medical theory, which held that disease was a divine punishment meted out by angry and vengeful gods, so if you're sick, maybe try not making the gods so angry and vengeful all the time. It still had no relation to the realities of medicine or the human body, and any treatment based on the four humors will help you at best only through random chance. Nevertheless, medicine based on the four humors was practiced until 1858 CE, when cells were discovered and humans realized maybe not all disease could be cured through bloodletting, vomiting, gymnastics, and sensual massage. Just to be clear, that's more than 2,000 years that Western doctors treated patients based on the inaccurate and unhelpful idea of humor imbalances. That's longer than most civilizations have lasted, including, it must be noted, the Greek civilization that produced it. Medicine has progressed more in the few centuries after the four humors theory was abandoned than it had in all previous centuries combined. If you don't want people to needlessly die in your civilization, because you're a decent human being, and because being struck down early by disease is objectively a suboptimal ending to any human life, you'll want to introduce the basics of modern medicine quickly. Footnote, and it's not like humans leapt from four humors to, no wait, germs, directly. Many years were lost in Europe, India, and China with miasma theory, the idea that disease is caused and carried by bad smells. This theory at least had an upside. Since waste and decay usually smell unpleasant, public works designed to fix the problem of miasma could still actually help people. This happened in London. After its cholera epidemics and the Great Stink of 1858 CE, in which warm weather made the untreated human waste floating in the Thames smell worse than usual, the city invested in sewers to move smelly water away from the city. This was to be a marked improvement over the city's existing waste disposal system, in which everyone just dumped their poop into the streets or into nearby cesspools and then complained about how everything smelled bad all the time. It was only after the sewers had been completed and the health of Londoners had improved that humans realized it wasn't gross smells that carried diseases, but germs. London's dramatic and hugely expensive sewer system, still in use today, was constructed for entirely the wrong reasons and only happened to improve public health by accident. End footnote. Of course, it's not just Western civilization that ran into trouble developing medicine. Taboos against human dissection have arisen in multiple cultures across multiple eras, and while this is for understandable reasons, it feels weird to cut into a dead body and start poking around. Heads up on that. They have, in all cases, held back medical development. If you want to learn how to treat humans, you'll need to know how their bodies work, and dissecting animals and reasoning by analogy will only get you so far. Questions like, where does sweat come from? So, do arteries move blood or air or what? And, does the womb stay in one place, or is it like a separate animal that lives inside women and just kind of moves around wherever it wants? Have historically been best answered through human dissection. Footnote. This wandering womb theory is one that the ancient Greeks operated under and which infected Western thought until the 1800 CE. It was thought that hysteria, uncontrollable emotions that clearly only women could be subject to, was caused by the uterus moving throughout the body of its own accord, thereby putting pressure on the other organs. Treatment involved coaxing the uterus back into place with smells, bad ones near the nose to push it away, and good ones near the genitals to attract it forward. If that failed, sex was thought to be a good fallback treatment. When doctors, unsurprisingly all men, finally accepted that wombs weren't separate living things that traveled throughout the body, the idea of the wandering womb finally died. But the idea of hysteria persisted, and by the 1860s, it had evolved into a psychological ailment caused by women having too few orgasms. Masturbation was thought to be immoral, which meant that if a hysterical woman was unmarried, or her husband was unwilling, then there was no other option. Doctors themselves would have to massage women to orgasm. At the time, most Europeans thought sex had to involve a penis, so this was clearly just another unremarkable medical procedure. Medically induced orgasms took time, however, which led to the vibrator, a technology originally invented as a time-saving clinical device for tired medical professionals. End footnote. Thankfully, you've got the advantage of Appendix I, which features a human anatomy chart featuring the shape, size, location, and role of each major internal organ. Even that relatively simple information will advance medical treatment in your civilization by thousands of years. What follows is basic medical information that you can use in any time period on yourself or on your fellow humans. If you had any other option, we'd say yes, absolutely, go to a doctor rather than trusting what's effectively a brief aside in a time machine repair manual with your entire health and wellness, but you don't. So you may want to study this next section carefully. The germ theory of disease. Bad things happen when the inside of your body is colonized by invasive microorganisms, which is so disgusting, medical professionals refer to it by the euphemism infection. Microorganisms can take several forms, but the ones you need to worry about are bacteria, tiny animals, and viruses, tiny pieces of parasitic DNA coated in proteins that hijack cells, reprogramming them to produce more viruses until they burst. Footnote: are viruses alive? Well, they walk the line. They carry genes, they evolve, and they reproduce, but they can only do that last one after commandeering a host cell. Scientists today don't count them as life because they can't reproduce on their own and don't reproduce through cell division like all other life on Earth. End footnote. We call both bacteria and viruses germs, hence germ theory. If you're on Earth and you're seeing life beyond yourself, bacteria are absolutely unavoidable. They were among the first life to evolve. A gram of modern soil typically has around 40 million bacteria cells in it. And if that makes you feel uncomfortable, you're not going to like this next phrase. Bacteria cells outnumber human cells on and in your body 10 to 1. Footnote: human cells are much bigger, which is the reason, or one of them, that you look like a human and not like a slurry of bacteria. But it's true. If we were to divide your cells into human and bacteria piles, and then try to deduce what you are based on those raw counts alone, we wouldn't think you're human. We'd think you're a group of different bacteria that have figured out how to walk around and chat up other bacteria, and in the course of that, contracted a minor infection of humanity. End footnote. Not all bacteria are bad, and you need some to survive. The bacteria in your gut not only make digestion of several foods possible, including plant matter, and help train your immune system, but many have specifically evolved to live inside humans. So in a way, you're not actually trapped alone in the past. You and your gut flora are in this one together. Viruses are somewhat easier to avoid, but you'll still probably encounter them. All it takes is one interaction with a contaminated host, human or animal, or a surface they've interacted with, and you can get infected. You'll generally contract them through coughing, sneezes, touch, or other more intimate forms of contact. We're talking about sex. Warning, you must be 18 years or older to have read the previous sentence. You can protect yourself against viruses by introducing dead or weakened forms of different viruses to your body before a more deadly one shows up. This is called vaccination. But it's tricky to do without a medical establishment. However, you can still vaccinate yourself against at least one deadly virus, smallpox, and it's as easy as milking a cow. Cows can contract cowpox, which manifests